Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined by your other host, Mr.
Gabriel Krauser.
And yeah, it's most certainly a Friday afternoon. We've actually been pretty good recently with recording sort of on time, at least the past 2 weeks or so, haven't we?
We're getting
at least the past week.
Yeah, I think this is the first time 2 weeks in a row that we're going on a Friday. First time in since the pandemic started or something like that. Start new good habits, we also let go of old good habits, which we shouldn't do. The old good habit is, don't forget Two Crickets tagline, the smoothest glass of Amarula for your mind, this side of Mars. But this side of Mars part is especially good because that came after our episode about why it's a good idea to try and go to Mars, which came after
I completely forgot
about why
the
it's
Mars
a good idea to try and build pyramids.
That was a classic. I think that in many ways set the standard for what this podcast would become, the pyramids one. Also because we were, I think, drunk. Or at least a bit.
If you take me to court, I will neither confirm nor deny.
Indeed. Anyway, I haven't felt great inspiration for what to talk about today. Gabriel luckily did have some ideas. And the first one we want to talk about is just a little bit of an update of what's going on the, as we titled it in our episode, The Inscrutable East, which is the border between Ukraine, Belarus, and Mother Russia. So, Gabriel, you wanted to give everyone some thoughts about what we had said last time.
Yeah. So, I mean, 2 weeks ago, I think we got into a good argument about the what's going on there and what the merits are. And I enjoyed that. It was difficult. It's kind of been the case that since then, I've really seen no arguments about it. It seems to me that this really is a situation where echo chamber is the right word. Like, I often make the complaint that when people talk about echo chambers in regards to South African or American media, they're talking rubbish, right? Because if you ever watch CNN or the Daily Friend Show, any of the funnies, they're constantly bringing up clips from Fox News and then making fun of it.
Yes.
And if you watch Fox News, they do exactly the same, just with a shoe on the other foot. And in South Africa, there's a lot of that as well. There's a lot of like bringing the other side out and mocking it. I get whipped out in debates about BEE and I get called a wonderful person. I always get complimented. we have debates. We just talk with each other. Whereas here, I feel like the two sides don't touch.
There is also, partly it's because I think a lot of the time they're literally in different countries speaking different languages. There is this, partly I think what you described there, you could maybe make the argument that it's also sort of a feature of an echo chamber, more maturely understood, or more complexly understood, in that it's what David French calls nut picking, where you don't really go and say, oh, this is someone who actually is quite reasonable from the opposite view. Let them say their piece. You find the most deranged, incomprehensible, hysterical lunatic from the other side. And you say, well, look at what they're up to now, those people over there.
So you think I was being nutpicked?
Yes.
No, I wasn't. Dude, the first time I went on SABC to debate BEE, the host and the other panelists agreed with everything I was saying, and I agreed with pretty much everything they were saying.
So have they come out against BEE?
They did, dude. I did an SABC interview quite a while ago, a year and 2 years ago. And I said, I can feel a change in the air. And Franz said, you must remember this moment. He said, this moment reminds me of the time that the Nats sort of were like, we'd rather let a black person into the team than lose in some sport. I don't know if it is cricket or rugby, but there's some famous story from the 70s or whatever.
I don't know. France said, once you do that, there's no going back.
You can't go. Then non-racial
ideological. Your ideological racist prison is shattered.
Yes. So once SABC let me on and we all agreed, that was my triumph moment. It was not nut picking. But yes, there is nut picking. This is different. We haven't even gotten to the stage of nut picking. Most people just don't agree. They live in entirely different language universes, fact universes, and so on.
Right.
And
it's like a good old 19th century geopolitical squabble when you couldn't talk to people from other countries because, you know, it would take two days for the mail to arrive. Yeah. And you would write to your Russian friend. You'd say, "I'm most distressed at the prospect of war in Europe again." And your Russian friend would write back and he would say, "Ah, it is most tragic."
It's very sad. They often, before both world wars, there was a sort of interesting thing about almost taxi drivers turning into scouts for the body politic of Paris, because no one could trust the news anymore, or whatever the government was putting out there. So you'd sort of rely, but then the rumors would come, no, the Germans are coming, you've got to flee Paris. And then the next wave of rumors would come, no, they're just saying that so that you leave all your stuff and then they come rob your stuff or so that they can get taxi fares. So, and they did really well. I mean, Paris was evacuated pretty effectively by taxi. And also taxis were used in World War II to defend Paris against the old. And in World War I, there was like some horse buggies. Anyway.
I'm pretty sure that there was a point where taxi drivers had to fill in doing logistics or something. I can't remember quite early in the war because French didn't have drivers or trucks or something.
Yeah, because certain army battalions had kind of given up. And then they put up a bit of a brave fight. Anyway, the point is that we do have, in some ways, more reliable information systems, in some ways not. Here's an example. I think a couple of weeks ago I mentioned that part of the reason, without relitigating the whole question, part of the reason a lot of Russians feel aggrieved by what's going on in Ukraine is that the Ukrainian government underwent a coup in 2014. I felt a little bit insecure. I was like, let me go and dig into this coup. And firstly, it's amazing. No one mentions the coup, right? And the whole point is that the Crimeans were like, okay, once the democratically elected president has been taken out by force, we don't have to respect this country anymore, and we can have a referendum to join a country that's not a complete rubbish country that has coups all the time. And the same for the people in the Donbass, but they were denied a referendum, which is what they've been fighting over in their minds ever since. So that's the version of the story on which the Russians sound pretty reasonable, and the Ukrainian government sounds pretty terrible. But what are the details of the coup? So, I mean, Poroshenko, Yanu, it's not Poroshenko. He's the guy who comes afterwards. You've got Timoshenko, who's in jail, and you've got Yakunovich.
But what Ukrainian politician hasn't been in jail at some point?
Exactly. The current Ukrainian president, Zelensky, is trying to put Poroshenko in jail for treason, for selling coal to Russians and buying coal from Russians in the Donbass region, which is like, oh, it's like filthy, filthy, filthy. You can't touch the Russians. It's treason. Which is hilarious because Zelensky is collecting billions of dollars from Russians in transit fees from the oil, from the gas that goes through his thing. So he'll be tried for treason soon enough. Anyway, even Zelensky's allies are very embarrassed at him trying to put the previous president in jail. But literally the last four presidents of Ukraine have tried to put the previous president in jail.
Yes, Ukraine does not have a very stable government.
Which is why some people think it's not so unreasonable to try and, you know, be in a different country. But I promise... Nick and I promised each other that we would not relitigate this matter, so I'm not going to do that. The point is just this. With the coup, the technicality is that, you know, okay, so there's the insurrection in Kiev, in the capital. 130 people are killed from December through February because Yanukovych said that he wants to abandon the EU path and join do business with Russia. $15 billion of Ukrainian debt is bought by the Russians. The Russians cut the gap price to Ukraine by a third. So you know, Ukrainians can buy cheap gas. It's really good for them. And this is freaking out the pro-EU guys who worried about it. So they up the ante on the insurrection. And eventually they invade the Ukrainian Union buildings and the president runs away and he says his car is being shot at. And the next day they say, well, the president's fled, so he's abandoned his office. So parliament's going to get together and vote for a new president, vote him out and vote for a new president. This is how they accomplish the coup. And it's only opposition parties in parliament, but, you know, that hardly matters. Now, there's two versions of the story that I've drilled down to, like, McGill University professors and what was the other university? University of Warwick, Ilwich, and two or three universities in the UK. We had professors, you know, East Europe expert professors writing their things on The Conversation and other sort of credible highfalutin sources. And they've got completely different versions, right? So the one version is that he was impeached. And on that version, the following facts don't get mentioned. In the Ukrainian constitution, you can't be impeached unless the constitutional court presides over the matter, which it didn't do. And you can't get impeached unless you get a three quarters majority of parliament or whatever it is, two thirds. And they didn't get that many votes. So they missed the votes and they missed the procedure. So he could not legally have been impeached. So he's illegally impeached. Now, if you read the pro-Russia English sources from universities like the University of Chicago, then you get the whole story and then you see, okay, it is an illegal impeachment. But then there's the other version, which is that he wasn't impeached, that in fact, you can only impeach a guy if he's broken some kind of law. And he didn't break any law. He just ran away. And there was no formal procedure for that, which is why Parliament could just pass a law by a simple majority to say, you know, here's a new law. If the president runs away, he's no longer the president. and that's a simple majority. Now, that's a great story because, for example, the McGill professor who writes that story completely and says this is really good. You know, this is ingenious parliamentary. You know, these are lawmakers who are really putting the people's interests first. And it's a very good thing that they didn't invite the apex court to see over this because no one trusts the Ukrainian court. And if the Ukrainian court had said this is a good idea, everyone would have said it's pro-opposite. You know, it's pro the new government. And if they'd said, no, it's a bad idea, they would have just said it's pro Yakunovich. They would have gotten their hands messy.
Fairly safe to say this is the kind of problems
you can get into when you don't have. What this person does not mention at the University of McGill is that the president was violently chased away. That he didn't, you know, she leaves the reader with the impression, which most people in the Anglosphere would have because they haven't even heard of the coup in the first place and have forgotten about the insurrection, leaves the reader with the impression that the president sort of just found it all a bit tiring and so decided to leave. And then Parliament was like, well, what do you do? I mean, she even says there's this hypothetical situation where if a president knows they're about to lose a vote, then they just abandon their office. And then you can't impeach them because they haven't broken a law, but you can't remove them because the only way to remove them is by impeachment. So what do you do? Well, Parliament's got to pass this 50% plus one idea of you can't abandon your office. This is this professor acts as if this is this equivalent to 130 people being killed on the streets outside your office and then your office being taken over by gun wielding, fire setting, insurrectionists, insurgents. anyway, so it's kind of it's two levels of crazy within a level of crazy, which I find interesting. But here's the in terms of the old silo world, the most siloed fact of the day is that the Russian Parliament has been deliberating on the nature of East Ukraine, of the Donbass. This is literally the only place it's covered in English that I can find is the Moscow Times, which is pretty credible sort of Putin critic independent newspaper. Not as famous as Novaya Gazeta, but also much more serious than Nova Gazeta in some ways. Nova Gazeta is the Russian newspaper which won the Nobel Prize effectively last year.
Yeah, I think you actually talked about it in an episode we've done. You talked about the whole story of them. Yeah.
And I've been reading them for the last few months, and I continue to be really disappointed at the really poor quality of writing. In the same way that the Daily Maverick has like by swallowing up Scorpio Amabungani, gotten a lot of the best investigative journalists, although they weren't actually in charge of some of the best investigative journalism at the time, are currently in charge of a lot of the best investigative journalists, but have a lot of like pretty silly fluff on the side. Nova Gazeta has the bravest journalists in Russia, some of whom many years ago have been killed in the course of their duties of seeking truth and putting it out there. But it's writing, the editors don't really believe in editing, and the writing style is pretty dismal. There are grammatical mistakes. And I was like, I can't be calling out grammatical mistakes. So I've passed it over Russians. And they're like, no, dude, these people just like aren't even writing in proper Russian. Okay. Moscow Times is much more boring kind of newspaper. They've covered this a little bit, but you actually have to read the Cyrillic news to see what Parliament's been doing. Now, why does that matter? That matters because 2 weeks ago, Nick and I litigated what are the merits of the case? What's really going on there? Who's Evel Knievel? And a week ago, we just mentioned the Ukraine story by saying, you know, all the saber rattling seems like much ado about nothing in a way. We were covering this story in a sense way back last year when Russia was first building up troops. And if they wanted to do an attack, it would be a surprise attack. They wouldn't wait for the UK and the US to arm the Ukrainians to the teeth. They wouldn't wait for everyone to be watching and to have made up their mind that the Russians are evil. They would have snuck in a little bit like they did. With Ukraine, they were very quick in Crimea, and they were very quick in Abkhazia and Ossetia and Georgia as well. So now that it's over, this is something else is going on. And in my view, what's going on is they're trying to get the gas lines reopened, but it could be something else. At this stage, it could be something else. But it's not too bad, and everyone else is making a big noise, even exaggerating how bad it is. What's changed my mind in that prognosis, where last week, your line, Nicholas, you put it quite nicely, we seem to be in the eye of a storm, in the eye of a hurricane, not just in terms of this, but in terms of anything. So that is quite a peaceful time.
Right, generally with global affairs.
Yeah. What makes me think the eye of the hurricane might narrow to non-existence in the Donbass, and that there might actually be serious military conflict, and that a lot of, you know, tens of thousands of people will die, and global markets will be affected, and geopolitics will be affected for the next decade, is that the Russian parliament has met up this week to discuss the matter, and will be voting on it in early February. This is the sort of hidden fact. I think it's hidden because most people outside of Russia are not willing to think about Russia accepting like this. Putin's in charge and everyone does what Putin says or is fighting against Putin. But it's like, you know, everyone's...
But correct me if I'm wrong, but Russian politicians do have a history of saying things that are, shall we say, indelicate.
Yeah.
And that's your fear, presumably, is that some windbag from somewhere is going to stand up and be like, you know, it's time we taught these Ukrainians a real lesson about whatever, and that could cause things to spiral out of control.
Not just say something, but pass a resolution. What they are going to vote on is whether they should recognize the People's Republic of Luhansk and the People's Republic of Donetsk as Russian territory.
Right.
Now, there's some reason to say so, right? Since the coup in 2014, those two regions have not participated in any Ukrainian elections, although there have been several. They have tried to participate in Russian elections, but have been denied that by the Russians. They have tried to hold referenda on gaining independence and or joining Russia, and have been denied the ability to do that effectively. They, unlike Crimea. So whereas Crimea is recognized by the Russian parliament, an act of Russian parliament recognizes Crimea. That's why Crimea has voted in the last two parliamentary elections and in the last presidential election. But Donetsk and Luhansk, the Donbass in general, are not recognized as part of Russia. And there's very good reason for that. The Russians in general, Russian strategists, would very much like the Donbass to stay in Ukraine. It does not suit them for Russia to take that territory. Because if they take that territory, Ukraine becomes more purely Ukrainian. And that's exactly their worry. that they've got a neo-Nazi race nationalist Ukrainian neighbor. And there is some evidence to suggest, you know, there's some evidence to support that assessment of what the Ukrainian government is. Certainly, if what Minsk to the agreement that Russia and France and Germany and the US and the Ukrainians all signed on to several years ago, the peace deal, was that the Donbass would stay inside of Ukraine with a special autonomous respect, so it'd kind of be a federal system. The whole reason the Russians want that is because as long as that's the case, the Ukraine will never join NATO and the Russians will never have to deal with NATO being on their border. If Parliament, however, votes to say, well, that was clever geostrategy, that's coming from clever clonks like Putin, we don't think like that. We think that these are Russian people. У них есть русский дух. These are русский кровь. These people share our blood. They've been denied franchise in Ukraine. They've been denied franchise here. They've been fighting and dying to join us. We should respect that. If a majority of parliament votes to do that, Putin will have no choice but to invade. Or for his little green men to take their uniforms off and become the Russian soldiers that in some senses they always were. And that will trigger, you know, it'll reintroduce sad conditions for people like my fiance's family who, you know, I know people who have died probably because the medicine that they relied on got too expensive because of sanctions in previous rounds. When GDP drops 2-3%, that increases social tension, which has negative effects on people's mental health and crime and suicide and all kinds of things. You know, it's not actually great to be submitted to serious sanctions. Of course, most Russians would never admit this. They lean into it quite eagerly and cheers their vodka and they say, stuff those guys, if we can't eat French cheese, we will drink more vodka. Very, very, very spirited responses to sanctions. I was in Russia when they first got hit by sanctions after the Crimea referendum or the annexation, however you want to put it. Amongst people who are very critical, most of them very critical of Putin, but also very critical of the West, quote unquote. Anyway, the point is that it'll be sad for the Russians. I think it could also be really, and I'm sad for thousands or tens of thousands of soldiers who kill each other on either side of the fence, completely devastating for the residents of the area, and some spanners in the works beyond that. Now, the final point on the Russian parliament is that it's not run by Putin, quite literally. It's just the last thing that people can, you know, everything's run by Putin. Not the Russian parliament. His party lost its majority last year, which I mentioned in comparison to the ANC. His party's like got 30% endorsement. He has 60%, which is pretty much exactly the same as Ramaphosa and the ANC. And much like in our municipal elections, in fact, before the municipal elections, one of the reasons I was so confident in predicting this was I was saying this experiment has kind of played out in terms of the polling. Levada is kind of like the pollster and think tank of Russia that sits in the same position as the IRR. And they made predictions much like ours, which were exactly right on the basis of their polling, which is pretty much, you know, it's good stuff. So who's taken over? Well, no one really. There's a sort of coalition. And there's hardly a coalition really needed because it's not direct proportional representation. So that, you know, they're on 49%, but they don't quite have what it takes. And they're not going to be the guys who push it over the line. They might not even vote for it at all. You might get the party splits and some abstentions from what I can tell. The guys who are into it are the third largest party who are hardcore jingoist race nationalists, much like the Ukrainians. And they draw a lot of spirit from the Ukrainians, whereas the Ukrainians are like passing race laws to say that Russians aren't indigenous and Ukrainians are and Cossacks are. These are Russians who think that, you know, we should be passing similar indigene laws in Russia, who think that Russia's problem is that it's not big enough. These are a little bit like, as far as I can tell, the ruling party's attitude to them is a little bit like Putin's attitude to the head of Chechnya, which is complicated. Some people will read them as mere puppets. But you could ask yourself in a South African context, do you think that the EFF are the ANC's puppets, or are they a radical group that, you know, took ANC ideology and distilled it and accelerated it and tried to get the ANC to follow along with them? Depending on what you might think about that, you might think one way or another about what's going on in Russia. The second largest party is the Communist Party, which sometimes gets irked by Vladimir Putin's criticism of Lenin in terms of the Ukrainian split, but sometimes not. Anyway, the Russian Communist Party is communist a little bit in the way that the Chinese Communist Party is communist. But it is a lot more vodka soaked, and that sounds like kind of stereotypical, but if you just look at their campaign ads, they're quite, that's they've the got a lot one, of,
is it?
Yes, the donkey one, which is great. It's best campaign ad in the 21st century. There's, as far as I can tell from scanning the Cyrillic news, the real war drum is being beaten from outside the party with the most votes in parliament. If they just split a little bit, they'll get a majority, and then Putin has to follow through or resign, because it is the executive's duty to follow the legislature's determination. That's a long spiel. Sorry, this is supposed to be 5 minutes.
I don't think anyone believed that. Do you, on a completely vaguely related tangent, do you know much about the origins of the Cossacks?
Well, I do, in the sense that I've been reading a ding dong thing, including Vladimir Putin's essay on the subject, and some academics in Russia and some academics in Ukraine disagreeing about this.
What year did they start the story?
They start the story around, I want to say, the 800s.
So the version of the story that I've read is that basically the Cossacks are this kind of semi-settled, they're like, if you can imagine the steppe peoples, like the Tatars and the Cumans and the Kipchaks and the Mongols, who live out on the grassland, and they mostly just herd animals and ride horses and that kind of thing. And then you've got like an intermediate zone, and then you've got people who live in towns or villages and farm for a living and, you know, focused far more on sedentary lifestyle. That in a lot of ways, the Cossacks are kind of a weird, they're that middle ground. They sort of nomadic, they're sort of not nomadic, they have their own culture, and they come in a lot of ways out of serfs fleeing very restrictive autocratic lords in both Russia and Poland. And they go basically to the steppe grasslands because there's no one can control you there. It's impossible to rule. And they create these sort of strange communities that then become semi-integrated with the state as like professional soldiers. They're first used by the Poles for a very long time to basically tame the steppe and protect against Tatar raids, which were a very common thing and resulted in an enormous number of slaves being taken from Eastern Europe. And then later the Cossacks switched sides and joined the Russians. And what's interesting about them is they were famous for their allegedly democratic internal self-governance. And so one of the great ironies of them is that they became sort of the fist, because they were sort of separate from the rest of Russian society, they became the fist of the Tsar's autocratic repression machine. Whereas they themselves were far more democratic than pretty much everyone else. They somehow got this reputation as being the tool of Tsarist oppression, which is kind of a weird thing about Eastern European history. But anyway, I don't understand them very well, but I'm very interested in them.
Tolstoy, the famous one, has
I assume not Tolstoy the cigarette seller.
uh, there's the other, there's the less famous one. He wrote the only full text of his that I read in Russian was a story about a Cossack, a sort of military expedition. Tolstoy himself was rather the soldier gentleman in a way in his early life, and then sort of only after he got bored with, as some versions go, got, you know, became sexually bored in marriage, did he settle down into vegetarianism and long-winded novel writing. This is, look, Russians are pretty harsh in how they describe their heroes. This is coming from someone who loves Tolstoy, not me. I can't say that I know his work well enough. But I did read the story, and it was, you know, sort of quite sad, humiliating accounts of the Cossacks being the Cossackness being ground out of the Cossacks by vodka daily allowances as part of their army rations, by long requirements for tours of duty. But to date it back to the 800s, the alternative story goes like this, and this is in a way the historical way to historicize the conflict, which I don't think is enlightening to try and understand the conflict. I think it's enlightening to try and understand how stupid humans are. So the Ukrainian version, and we heard someone give this version at the Liberal Club, whose name I won't mention because that's against the rules. You know, Ukrainians have always been freedom-loving.
I wasn't actually there for that one. I will make a distinction. There is a difference between Cossacks and Ukrainian Slavs.
Not according to the Ukrainian law, the indigenous race law, which was passed in 2018. According to that law, whatever kind of Cossack you are, you are a Ukrainian. But if you are a Russian, then you are not a Ukrainian. It's a pencil test law. It is a it's a bloodline law, but without proper bloodline analysis. So it's just, I mean, it's pencil test madness.
No, I'm saying I think you may be slightly wrong there in that there was I mean, that may be the modern distinction, but in the past definitely there was this. You know, Cossack is a very weird identity because
they've got three subcategories. Yeah. They define Cossacks. I can't remember the other two, not Tatar. Cossacks and two other subgroups as counting as indigenous Ukrainians.
Right. So I don't know. I don't know what the anything about the modern Ukraine laws of this, but what I do know is that you know, to be a Cossack didn't necessarily mean. It suggested that you were probably an Orthodox Christian rather than a Catholic.
Now you're talking like Putin. Now you're hitting Putin's talking points.
It was also in part a profession. So there was a role of Cossacks that the Polish government had, and then later the Russian government. And then you were a listed Cossack, and then there were Cossacks who were unlisted Cossacks. We sort of lived in the same community, and it was kind of a lifestyle. It was kind of a culture. It was kind of
a little bit like samurai. Yeah.
Right. And this was often differentiated from, I think they used to call them the Ruthenians, which is like the old name for Ukrainians, or the Western of the Eastern Slavs.
So let's get back to the ancient history. So the two stories are this. The one story is this Ukrainian story that I was trying to mention at Liberal Club, where there are these tribes that divide and unite, but really what they have in common, aside from a kind of supposed what they have in common is a love for freedom, unlike their neighbors. And this is what eventually leads to their destiny of sort of forming Ukraine. This is the bloodline of freedom. And it's very wonderful. And it's clearly not Russian, because the Russians enslaved everyone and they were very terrible to the Ukrainians, and they did a genocide in the early parts of the Soviet, you know, the famine, where mostly Ukrainians suffered. So that's one. The other version, Putin's version, is that, no, there's one people here. They are the Rus. he's aware of there being Slavs, but to him, Slav is like white. It's like not really an interesting unifying concept. Interesting unifying concept is smaller than that. It's the Rus, which does not include Aryans. Very, very much does not include Aryans. The Germans are their natural enemies, as are the Mongols. And they united, let's say, around 800.
To be fair, the Mongols are most cultures' enemies.
Look, very including Ukrainians. Yeah, no, there's not a lot of fond memories of the Golden Horde.
There are very few population groups that have lived next to the Mongols who have thought, you know, those guys are just swell.
Anyway, so what unites them is religion, Orthodox Christianity, and you see this version of history really does get written about in the 1100s. And formal Russia, in a sense, starts in 910 AD.
What was the what's it, Prince Vladimir? Is it the one who baptizes the Kievan Rus? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he becomes the first Christian monarch in that part of the world because he was seeking a Byzantine alliance at the time.
And there's this wonderful name of the history that's written in 1162, which it's like, you know, recollections of troubled times or something like that. Which says there were three kinds from the beginning. There've always been these three kinds of Russians. There are sort of the borderland Russians, which the Mala Russians. There are the upland Russians, the Velika Russians, and then there are the sort of Russians in the snow, or the Russians that are whiter. It's hard to tell. The Belarusians, Bieli, as in many European languages, means white. So the Belarusians, the Mala Russians, and the Velika Russians, and the Mala Russians include many, many different tribes, some of which later get identified as Ukrainian. Ukrainian earlier has a different kind of sense to it. As just being the vanguard, I mean, Ukraina in Russian and in Ukrainian basically means border or edge. Where Kiev is not the edge of anything until after the colonization by the Khans, the Mongolians. And in the process of decolonization, Moscow pips it in the balance of forces game. Putin sort of glides over how they managed to do that. They basically seized the tax power from the Khanate and said, we will tax our neighbors and then pay whatever you want back to you. We've talked about tax farming. It's like a very difficult thing to deal with taxes in it.
I assume Putin didn't use the word decolonize for the steps there, because like the Tatars, the Mongols, the Cumans, the whatever, have been living on the steppe since, you know, the horses domesticated.
No, they're decolonizing the steppes from the Khanate's rule.
Yeah, well, it's not. So the steppe is where the Khanate comes from. I mean,
decolonization of South Africa doesn't mean getting rid of all white people. It means no longer falling under the yoke of the Westminster.
Right. So, I can think of this as, I don't know. It feels like two phases. There was one where you're subjects, and then there's one when you sort of went on the offense, and then the steppes became Russia. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. So there's the decolonization of Russia, and then there's the double decolonization of Russia, or the recolonization of Russia, or really just the imperial expansion of it. No, he doesn't get too much into that, because that's not his focus. Because his focus is more on the Ukrainian side. But with the Ukrainian side, it's very much the same story. So the story with the Cossacks is that these are good Orthodox Christian people who belong to the broader family of Rus, and they are taken over, you know, first by the Khanate, and then that goes away, and then it's all back to sort of happiness, and then they get taken over by the Lithuanians, and then the Polish join in that, and then the Polish-Lithuanian, and then the Polish sort of fully take over, and then that's a bit of a nightmare, and then the Russians end up liberating them from that, and then it's all very better. Then there's like a very long, complicated thing that happens around the period of the inception of the Soviet Union, where you've got lots of delegations coming particularly from the Donbass to say we want to be on the Russian side of things. You've got lots of delegations saying we should all be one country. And then you've got some delegations, which Lenin leads, saying, no, we're going to split this up. And Lenin rejects the petition to either redraw or draw the border so that the majority Russian-speaking areas would fall inside of the Russian part, the actual Soviet Union. And instead, they get stuck in the Ukrainian part. And at that, and of course, by that point, the notion of Cossack has been eroded in the sense that the role in society that Cossacks played is no longer viable. And in the sense that the social identity, the salient social identities that mattered in the day had become different. And Putin is quite careful, as are most Russians. It's a very strange thing about most Russians. I'm very careful, that I know at least, very careful not to talk about the Soviet rejection of Orthodox Christianity very often. But when they do mention it, it has kind of increasingly become described as the cardinal sin of the Soviet Union. More than any other mistake, this is really what the Soviets got wrong. And it's a delicate matter. I mean, I think as time progresses, the trajectory of Russia to becoming an increasingly Christian nationalist, Orthodox nationalist state, which is quite interesting because it really is a very multiracial place in a lot of ways, and it's a way to deal with that. But it's also quite dangerous in some ways. And
well, because it's quite a lot of Russians who aren't Muslim, who aren't Christians.
Yeah, and that friction is surprisingly low at the moment, and has been surprisingly low, right? But
except for Chechnya.
Yeah. Although is Chechnya part of Russia? you know, when you're going to get clever about redrawing things. So the point is that on this version of the story, the Cossacks, like everyone else in that area, were Rus, were part of the same race, basically from the beginning, from as far back as anyone would care to remember, at least as far back as the days when Orthodox Christianity was spreading. And then were messed about from two sides, firstly from these sort of heathens and then from these Catholics. And so have had a really tough time of it and need to be treated with extra special respect. And in that regard, I see the same attitude being expressed today as I see in both Tolstoy and even more so the work of Mikhail Lermontov in the 1840s, who's very much writing about Cossacks in that vein. Something impinged role, somewhat victimized by history to look up to. And I think part of the reason that Cossacks play, I think part of the function of Cossacks is that they kind of exemplify or distill something that culturally a lot of Russian culture seems to be built around. Harsh history, tragic fate, nevertheless, like quite a militant and stoic face to bring to bear on it. A sort of an unwritten code and a good spirit. Now, what that amounts to in realpolitik terms, is a war of words between Ukrainian leaders and Russian leaders, which feels very racy to me, where the one side is saying we're two different races. The Ukrainians are saying there's Ukrainians and we've got our own story. And yes, we got a bit buggered around by the Polish, but we fought against that. We got buggered around by you guys, but we fought against that. We are our own race state. We're going to be great as our own race state. And you got the Russian story, which is like, nah, dude, we all belong to one big family. You know, within the larger race of Rus, there are these subcategories. but this is the larger one. And it's quite different to what was happening between about 1880 and 1914, where Moscow and St. Petersburg and Kiev and, you know, anyone who could read a newspaper in Serbia, especially Serbia, but also the rest of the Balkan states, was talking about the Slav race. And part of what's different between the Slav and the Rus is precisely that the Rus story excludes all the Balkans, who are...
That's convenient.
Who are, you know, so there kind of is this wisdom in how the race narrative has evolved.
Yeah, you see, that's what that's been one of the great...
It's really not better. It feels like a very counterproductive way to be thinking about what's going on here. And I think it's a lot like how some people think of the Israel-Palestine conflict. They think the way you solve the Israel-Palestine conflict is by figuring out who got here first, or if we agree that everyone kind of, that's the wrong way to think about it, then the way you should think about it is who infringed upon whom first in the worst way. And so you can go back 10 years or 30 years or 50 years or 200 years, or as it turns out, you can go back in that situation kind of more than 2,000 years. In some ways, the Donbass is slightly less complicated because I haven't heard anyone try to go back further than 800, 900 AD.
Well, it's because no written evidence exists from before then.
Excepting for Herodotus. You see, my thought is that Herodotus writes about the Scythians with the greatest respect of all. And I kind of think that all of this comes down from the Scythians.
Scythians are definitely not Slavs, though. Scythians are steppe nomads. They're more like Turks.
Well, the Cossacks are pretty steppe nomadish.
Well, that's the thing, is that they're kind of the sort of weird in between, right?
And if you think that they look too dark or something, I mean, looks can and do change over 2,500 years. I just want to say about the Scythians. The reason I like the Scythians is because the story there is that they would, in order to be initiated, as a man, you'd have to sort of scalp, you'd have to kill some people and take their scalps off, and you'd have to sew them together. You sew the scalps of your enemies together to make a blanket that you put over your horse. And until then, you have to ride like full bareback or run around on your feet. And once you've got one blanket of scalps, you can ride that as a leather cushion on the horse. And then if you kill more, you can get a second blanket. That's a very heroic
story.
And then you get if you want to own more than one horse, you have to kill enough people to make more than one blanket. And the thought there is, this literally is as far back as you can kind of go. The thought there is that when the Persians, what we would now call the Persians, are trying to invade the Greeks, Sparta 300, all of that, they end up coming south to the Greeks because they don't want to go north to the Scythians, because Xerxes won, Darius won, I think, was so humiliated by the Scythians.
Well, famously,
the most outrageous.
The first Persian emperor, what was it, Cyrus the Great, was apparently killed by a Scythian warrior queen when he decided to invade the steppe. Until basically the firearm was not just invented but became, you know, very good. It was very difficult to rule the steppe.
You couldn't do, but you're missing the best detail. The queen not only killed him, she sent an emissary before the battle to say that she would drink from his skull. And then she did.
Yes.
She cut off his head and deep-brained him and then had a slicky drink. And then Darius II came down to try and avenge his father's death and had like 100 men carry a bowl of silver with his water because he had to drink the special water that was only touched by silver. This mad kind of thing. Anyway, they get there, and the Scythians are all lined up on one side of the river, and there's like 10,000 of them, and the Persians are there, and there's like 500,000 of them or whatever it is. And they all line up for battle, and there's a whole bunch of confusing things that happen. But the kicker in the story of Herodotus is that as it's about to set off, a rabbit sort of springs from the bushes near the Scythian front lines. And the Skellions are so sick of like standing around and like waiting to do this formal battle thing that somehow has been agreed upon, that he goes and runs after the rabbit because it's like a bit of a tradition there to see, you know, some youth are fast enough and agile enough that they can actually catch a rabbit with their bare hands, which if you've ever been around a rabbit, you know, it's pretty outrageous. And then another youth breaks out to try and catch the rabbit. And then Darius too says, what the hell's going on? Their front line is breaking. Are they coming after us? Then it's turning to the left. Like, what's going on? And the emissary runs down, asks the general, he sent someone down, asked someone right on the front line, you know, sort of 400 meters away from the Skellion's front line, comes back up the hill, says, no, what happened is there was a little rabbit that started running around and they got distracted and they're chasing after the rabbit. And the general says, dude, this is perfect timing. Like, they're broken formation. Like, we've got to go and take them now. We've got 20, 30, 50 to 1 odds numbers on our side. And Darius too says, the gods have prophesied that I would see my death here. And it must be so, for see how unperturbed they are by the odds stacked against them. It must be that these are truly the God's chosen people. And he turns around and leaves with his tail between his leg because he just can't handle these sort of rapscallions. And there's a different version of the story the Persians tell where they say he just decided like these people would not be worth conquering. If they can't even take their life seriously enough to go to war properly and are instead going to chase off a rabbit, like there's nothing to be gained by
conquering,
which is a part of the story which resonates quite interestingly when you consider that Ukraine is the only place in the world I know of that has performed worse than ESCOM, for example. No, it has halved its power production output in the last 20 years.
To be fair, GDP probably
is lower than South Africa's, although it was one of the richest satellite states 40 years ago.
To be it's probably...
Presidents are all trying to erase each other.
Right. It's probably got some of the richest soil in the world. So if you can actually get it working, which is a very big, you know, if, it could potentially be quite pleasant. But so going back to the story of the version of history that you recounted from old Vlad,
And backed up some by many of others, hilarious. Yeah.
Right. You know, thinking about this and actually, you know, what I understand about Cossacks and Cossack identity, a lot of what this story really just tells me is how, you know, identity really is. People often pretend like they believe in race identity, but in reality, like these things, they're not real things. What is a Ukrainian? What is a Russian? These things, you know, have changed so much over the centuries. And the Cossack is a perfect example of that because they're this sort of, you know, if you went and you drew the bloodlines of people who you knew had Cossack ancestors back, you would find some of them were Slavs. Some of them were Tatars. Some of them were possibly even Poles or Lithuanians.
You're going to find Aryans. Yeah.
Right. Because... you know, they really were, like I said, they were this sort of weird cultural, military, ethno-religious sort of transition zone group, being semi-nomadic themselves, except when they lived in these big military camps called, I think it's a Sich, S-I-C-H? I don't know how to say it.
T-E-C-H, I would imagine. I think there's a T.
Possibly.
But I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure it's different in all of the different languages that they speak there. Also, by the way, the Cossacks, you could sometimes runaways could kind of go and become Cossacks. You could fall in.
And that's possibly how it started in the first place. Cossackness is people running off their estates, the noble estates, because Eastern Europe did historically have, well, at least since the 1200s, I think, some of the most repressive of all feudalism. So in, you know, France and England, for example, there were quite a lot of peasants who owned their own land and didn't owe service to a lord and could do things without their lord's permission, like get married. Whereas in Eastern Europe, that was not impossible, but much rarer.
Some of the most famous Russian paintings, when they finally stop painting just purely religious scenes, it's a beautiful painting called Svadba of a nobleman. So there was this nasty tradition where if a serf was to be married, have to be a virgin, obviously, young lady,
You're going to talk about Prima Nocta.
It's not true.
It's very interesting, this, actually. So
this is not Prima Nocta. Let me just finish about the painting. Yeah. The painting is where the master actually decides to marry the girl.
The girl instead of the original husband, yeah.
And so you see, and that definitely would be a power that he bought. And so you see this, like, super wrinkly, like the under lids of his eyes are like showing red because the droop is so hard. Dude, beautifully painted, marrying this like 13-year-old girl.
So the interesting thing about Prima Nocta is it's this story that keeps coming up in historical sources, but no one ever says it's happening or it's allowed, or there's no evidence that it was ever allowed. It's always like they used to do this, and that's why things are better now. It's just curious because it's like,
well, look, I don't know. I mean, the idea certainly holds that there was unusually high levels of oppression.
No, for sure.
And that created reasons. I don't know that that's where the Cossacks started or any of these groups started, but look, there are also some analogs to what goes on in Basque country, on the other side of Europe. And my understanding is that the hill tribes around Korea have a version of history that's not entirely different themselves. Or rather has similar tensions insofar as there's a claim of like original sedentariness. There's also a claim of like this being a home for fugitives from oppressive, highly centralized regimes.
China and Japan.
Yeah. And that the combination of those claims is not really tested too much because races are real things. They're just not... They really are social constructs. This is why social construct theory is actually an improvement on the biological thesis of race. Because if you drill down a Zulu bloodline or a Xhosa bloodline or a Cossack bloodline or a Rus bloodline or a Malarus or a Belarus or a Korean or whatever, you're going to find that the story gets very confusing very, very quickly. But if you hold on to a sense of team spirit and the thought that this is the team fighting against that team, you can go a long way so far that you can find yourself in the position of killing other people that you don't consider to be wrong in any sense, accepting that they belong to that bloodline, which threatens ours.
I seem to remember reading somewhere, and I for the life of me can't remember what the source of this was, but that you can detect Portuguese ancestry many Xhosa people because there are people who they are descended from who were shipwrecked, Portuguese sailors shipwrecked going around the coast of Africa in the 1500s. And the nearest Portuguese colony, which is at the time Lorenzo Marx, which is modern Maputo, very, very far away through, you know,
too far to walk.
Uncertain, wild, difficult, you know, difficult to traverse Southern Africa. And of course, they also didn't really know the way. So they were like, okay, well, I guess, you know, this is my life now. I'm now a Xhosa. And, you know, a couple of generations and you're never going to notice that person ever had children or ever integrated into that community. Of course, there's no one for them to speak Portuguese with. And, you know, the obvious physical markers of their ancestry disappear quite quickly. And yet, if you do the DNA testing, there it is, still hanging out in the very deep recesses of the genes somewhere, which is... But you know, the whole Ukraine thing, I mean, it's... Because, like, you go back and you say, okay, well, then there was Lenin kind of being pro-Ukrainian, and then there's Stalin as being anti-Ukrainian, and then there's Russification that goes on during the Tsar period and then stops and then goes on again.
You can't stop there. I mean, you have I think Brezhnev and Gorbachev both were Ukrainian.
No, it was only Khrushchev, wasn't it?
No, it's two.
I think it was only Khrushchev.
Khrushchev and Brezhnev.
Anyway, so
it's
so
two of this sort of. I can't remember which two it was. I don't really. I think it's ridiculous that people care. That's my point.
Yeah. But this has been a contentious issue basically since when was the, I mean, I think one of the reasons that the Cossacks, even though they're not necessarily the, you know, the true representation, you know, like, did the Cossacks speak Ukrainian? I don't actually know. But
at home, as it were, when they were riding the horse, when they went,
yeah, well, before they became part of the Russian Empire, did they speak Ukrainian?
No, you're going back to the assumption. Look, my assumption is that might be a version of the truth. The other version of the truth might be the Putin's version of the truth, where they were part of the Russian Empire before anything else, as it were, that there was no Russian Empire, that there was a series of tribes.
No, but I mean, before the languages that would become Russian existed, they were speaking the language that would become Ukrainian.
So the language that would become Ukrainian and the language would become Russian are the same language. That seems pretty much beyond dispute.
No, there was Ukrainian, a time when they were... Yeah, so they Ukrainian, both share, they both come from Old Slavonic, I think, right?
Yes, correct.
But then they did split at some point, right? So yes. I'm saying, did the before the Cossacks became part of the Russian Empire later... Were they speaking Western Rus? You know, one of these dialects that would eventually.
What dialect were they? Yeah, I mean.
So I don't know the.
I have no idea.
Right.
But I assume there's two versions. I assume that there's someone out there who's going to very confidently say, "No. These guys in 1232 were speaking a slightly different dialect." That's definitely much more Ukrainian. And then someone else is going to say, no, they're speaking a slightly different dialect that is definitely more meta-Russian. At that stage, you couldn't cut between the two. And I don't have an opinion. But then, I'm sure that there's someone out there who has strong opinions,
and then
depending on their current political views, not depending on the actual differences in evidence. Or the silos that they belong to. Yeah.
There's this funny thing that the Rus are a Scandinavian tribe. Or at least a name for Scandinavians, living in Russia, which makes the whole idea of, you know.
A whole pure bloodline thing. But, you know, yeah, I mean, you go to North, dude, you go to India and you'll find a very exciting story about what Aryan means.
Yes. Because I know that this is like one of those sort of historical areas that's contested, but I'm pretty sure that the consensus version at the moment is something along the lines of there were these tribes of Slavs and also Uralic people living along the sort of major river systems of what is today Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. And then Scandinavian warriors and explorers and adventurers came and set up little trading towns along the rivers there. Sometimes they conquered the locals. Sometimes they sort of just set up their own settlements. They colonized. And over time, the Scandinavians sort of melded into the larger Slavic population around them. But the political structures they created were the ones then that formed the first of Russia, which is the Kievan Rus state, which is the very first sort of. Russia.
I think there are different versions of that story as well. So one version is exactly
like
that.
Like I said, it's contested.
The other version. The other version, I'm just going against the contested. You said contested and consensus. The other version is that there are clearly invitations sent on multiple instances, but right at the beginning, for Swedes effectively to come and administer conflicts between people thinking of themselves as Rus or Slav. And the thought there was twofold. Partly it's kind of a deference to those who clearly have more power over technology, with the presumption being an understanding that if you are better at building ships, you must be better at getting people to not kill each other. Because one sure way not to build a ship is to just kill everyone instead of building a ship. And the other being... and this is where the two stories bleed into each other, that in fact, this is how it started in the first place. And that this was just a return to that status quo. So again, you get the sense of every colonial moment is also a liberation moment, and every liberation moment has a sense in which it is a new act of colonization. So when the Rus call in the Swedes to say, please come help administer us, is this like an imposed colonial? The third story is that they don't ask, they get forced. Is this a return to the ex-ante status quo? In other words, things started out with this sort of happy mixture of two groups, and now it's gotten too one-sided with just the locals, and we need some more of the skills that come from the north. Or is this a self-invited subjugation, or an enforced one? Now, I really don't have much to go on that other than sort of conversations with PhDs and professors, not of history, but who have very strong views about the history of Russia, and who all completely disagree with each other. So I'm very
well. Have you ever put two?
I started this with McGill University tells you that there was no coup because they voted to say that the president of Ukraine left in 2014, and in 2014 she neglects to mention that the president was chased out. It's on footage, not him being chased out, but it's on footage that the whole Kievan Square and the whole of Kiev was sort of overwhelmed by force, and that the Union buildings effectively were physically invaded. She doesn't mention that. This is a person writing in 2021 about 2014, omitting a hugely relevant fact. Then you've got another side writing about the president of Ukraine being impeached in Britannica, Britannica.com. The first encyclopedia I ever got in my life was Britannica. I mean, there is no more prestigious encyclopedia in the world. They went online. Go Google 2014 Ukraine Yanukovych. You will find description of an impeachment. And there you will find no mention of the fact that the impeachment could not have been legal because there are laws in the Ukrainian constitution about impeachment, and they require the court to oversee it, and that a certain number of votes be passed, not just a majority. In Britannica, it just says a majority of parliament voted for impeachment. So if we can't get it right about 2014, right? If two prestigious sources can be missing half the story so that neither of them really get to the thought that it's a coup, and in Russia you get the thought that it's a coup with hardly any mention of the fact that Yanukovych arrested Yulia Tymoshenko, the previous president.
Right. The belief amongst the Ukrainian protesters that Ukrainian president was shooting them with snipers and soldiers, and
there's trying hardly to crush any doubt. Yes.
Right. And that was because that's sort of how it started. I mean, that's what was so strange about this whole geopolitical crisis is it started from, oh, there's this decision to make one trade deal over another. And then it starts in protests, and then the protests escalate, and then there's repression, and then the protests get more violent, and then there's more repression, and then it just kind of gets out of, well, to where Russia and NATO are pointing at each other.
The whole world is obsessed. South Africans, every South African has an opinion on the insurrection last year. Every American, everyone in the whole goddamn world that speaks English has an opinion about the time on the 6th of January that a bunch of hooligans invaded the capital of America. Guess what? The president's were not deposed violently, right? In an actual case where an insurrection got out of hand, got violent, and a president was deposed, we can't settle on a version of the story. How can the same species of monkey that we are, barely descended from the tree, you know, possibly hope to disambiguate the history of the Dnieper, what lies between the Dnieper and the Volga River, between 700 and 1400... I'm not saying Nicholas loves this stuff more than I do, but I love this stuff. I love the history. I think the difference between us in some ways and a lot of the politics about this, well, at least in my case, is that I really am curious about that history because I think it's wonderful to try and find the facts, and it's wonderful storytelling. I really think that it should not be a way to try and figure out how to resolve a political conflict.
Right. Yeah, I must say, I'm going to be real. I blame Woodrow Wilson for all of this.
Well, yeah, Putin mentions Wilson in his essay as well, so you're doing very well as a Putinist today.
Dude, me and Putin, when it comes to Wilson, I think we're probably quite on the same page. Maybe not for the same reasons, but Woodrow Wilson being a malevolent scourge who destroyed so much of good stuff in the 20th century. that's something I could get behind.
And in his way, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin was a bit of a Wilson.
Yeah, well, they were both.
He made very similar jokes. I think there are more interesting and nuanced similarities.
They're both bookish. That's the simplest way I could put it. They were both killed by strokes, weren't they?
I can't say that I know either of the circumstances.
Because I know, you know that
heart attack, stroke, I don't know.
You know that amendment, like the 25th Amendment or whatever, the one that stupid people kept talking about using against Trump? Yeah. Right? Which would never work because of the way it's structured. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that was put in because Woodrow Wilson, towards the end of his time in office, had a massive stroke. And then his wife started running the country pretending to be him. And the afterwards, the Congress was like, okay, we need to have a way of making sure that never happens again. So the 25th Amendment was very specifically written to prevent Woodrow Wilson's
wife from running the country.
That's why he looked at it. Puppet. Exactly. Because he apparently had the stroke and was sort of basically incapable. It took him years to recover because he was just, and he was never the same, right? He was just finished. And she restricted all access to him, and all of his instructions suddenly started going out only in writing. Like, he didn't talk to him. And his wife was the only person who was allowed to see him all the time.
Yeah, there were some worries that Reagan was involved in a similar thing. But
end of the day. Yeah, that was after, probably, if there was anything, it was probably right at the end.
These things are, look, part of what I think is so comical about this is that this is a really good instance, in my opinion, not necessarily the proximate causes of the conflict, but rather the way that people are telling themselves the story in Moscow and Kiev through history. It is such an unstable thing about race is how you find the right size. What's the right size for the race to be? Because, I mean, and we had a nice episode on this, sort of the first episode where I was like, I'm going to go off on a grand theory episode. the theory that racism is just good family. The theory was that all of the world's worst political ideologies are family values taken to politics in the wrong way.
And I got to use the great Jonah Goldberg phrase, mixing your Gemeinschaft with your Gefälschaft or something, your macrocosm with your microcosm.
Yes, exactly. And a way to find that within the idea, you know, it's too late. That's an easy idea for people who've kind of grown up non-racialist. So maybe once or maybe a few times in your life you kind of rooted for one race over another, but for the most part that's not how your social programming worked. But you also grew up in a family, and so you've got that sense of shared pride, shared shame, shared collaborative efforts, a lot of irrational stuff, a lot of ritual, a lot of kvetching, and oh my god, did you hear what dad did, or mom saying this now, but also a lot of like love, and it's like the more you fighting, the more you love each other. It's a whole story with the family, you know. This is what most plays and books are about, the family. You can never have enough, but from the first gefilte
fish, the audience tonight. Can't see is that I'm making stereotypical Italian hand gestures with
Yes, my family and everything for my family. Okay, you know, so if you've grown up a little bit like that, you know, not super Italian or just a little bit like that, you know how different that is to how you think about the race that people tell you you belong to. And you can see how some people make the mistake of treating the race they belong to like a family. Like, oh, wow, someone in my family did something cool. I'm going to brag about that on Facebook. Oh, someone the same race as me made $1 billion. I'm going to brag about that. Be like, I'm so glad we're the same race. This person's showing me that people in my race can. Like, that's very, very silly mistake to make. But you can see how people could make that mistake. If you start out from the position that it's a mistake, but if you don't start out from that position, how can you point it out? Well, I think this is a way to point it out, which is to say, if you start out with the idea that races are, you know, they're bands of brothers and they need to work together and things are better when they're together. And that it's sort of like a naive individualism or kind of a selfishness, or since you brought up Italian, you know, this is why the Italians went so kaput, you know, because they made it all about family. Like, who then the families are fighting with the other families, the mafiosa. No, you need a nation state. You need to be like the German. You need like one nation state where we're all the same race in the nation and we fight together. You need to not be stupid like the Germans and go genocide Jews and Slavs and so on, because that makes everyone very angry with you. But if you like clever and you like the Germans, then it's going to be the best. There are a lot of people who think like that. So what do you do with people who think like that? Well, I think you point them to what's going on in the Donbass, and you point them past the one version of the story and the other version of the story. You try and point them to both versions of the story, at least in terms of how a lot of intellectuals are trying to cash it out in those respective areas. You say, look, on the one side, you've got these lawmakers in Ukraine saying, you know, it's really important to figure out that we're a Ukrainian state and that we are a freedom-loving people. Our bloodline defines that. And those Russians, they all love a Tsar, and they're a, you know, they're a sadomasochistic kind of depressive people who really like to be bullied and commanded around. We're not like that because it's just not in our blood. And so we need to keep separate from it. And then you've got the Russian side saying, look, guys, we're literally all one big happy family. But you know who's not in our family? The Germans. And you know how you can tell? Because they killed lots of you and lots of us for the same reason. Because we didn't belong to their family. Now, you might think that they're not going to do that again. But that's been thought before. And the guys who thought that before were wrong. So let's not make that same mistake. So you've got two competing race stories. It's almost as if it's too funny to be true. But this is the nature of humanity. We are still pulling ourselves out of the ooze. And
I think we need to assure the Russians, Belarusians, Ukrainians that the sites of the German state are now far, far away from Eastern Europe. They're much more focused on messing up economic development in the third world.
I don't know. On this version of the story, firstly, you notice that the Germans are shooting themselves in the foot by decommissioning nukes and then refusing to buy gas. But more importantly, that Germany, if you're going by bloodlines, you know, and this is what these people do, the Germans resettled pretty hard in America. And does Washington, D.C. not have its sights on expansion? Is Washington, D.C. prepared to spill Russian Rus blood, whether it's Malorusky, Bielorusky, Velikorusky? Very much. This is what the only thing CNN can talk about is their sights are literally, their cameras are pointed in their direction, waiting for the war to play out. I don't think any Belarusians are listening to this. If they were, they would see the Russian army march past out the window, and they would know that the American satellites are looking down on them. That there are no ambitions to expand into and impinge on this race blood story. I mean, there really are. And I think part of what's ironic about this conversation is that the liberal, those who propose liberal hegemony, those who are, you know, Nicholas, for example, is
much more sympathetic. Yeah, I was like, at me, please. That's a Twitter thing.
but it's not just you. Like, people who are for NATO expanding, for Ukraine joining NATO, Estonia joining NATO, and so on. Like, unfortunately, I never hear the argument. The reason you should join NATO is precisely because you should be joining a community of states where this bloodline stuff doesn't count for nothing, where that's stupid, where that's kind of rejected. And the reason that's not being said is because it's not how the leaders think, and I don't think it's how most supporters of NATO think. In fact, most supporters of NATO are making the same mistake as Woodrow Wilson did 100 years ago, which is to think the way you solve global conflict is by finding the right level of race politics, that if it's too large or too small, it becomes unworkable. But if you can find the right size of race to match with government, so that every government kind of gets its own race, at least in some places, then you're onto a winning formula to tackle the really big countries and make sure that they don't do too much mischief. I feel like we're in a very Woodrow Wilson moment in terms of NATO's misapprehension of the story and its support of neo-Nazis in Ukraine and Ukraine in general.
Yeah. I think part of the reason for Woodrow Wilson's endurance is the fact that he's never really been properly taken apart until the Wokeistas decided to start going after him for being a racist. But, like, you know, in the wrong way.
Yeah.
So they sort of got him. They got the right thing that was wrong about him, and that you know he was a racist. But they just don't explain it properly as to why that was the wrong thing about him.
Right. They say you're a racist because you thought one race was better than another, which is true. But he's also a racist in the sense that he thinks one race, one state. He thought that's a good idea. Right. That's a simpler. That's a much more dangerous idea, actually.
Yeah,
in the sense that more people have been killed.
I mean, people bring this idea up all the time when it comes to Africa, right? Yeah. It's like, oh, the reason that Africa's in a mess is because it has too many tribes together in one nation state. And it's like, I don't know about that one. I mean, people do definitely cluster around ethnicity, but I would argue that that's probably because they lack a strong state. Like, states, in a lot of ways, actually kind of create ethnicity because, as you know, we say race is a social construct. I seem to remember, and this may be wrong because I don't know much about Tanzania, but that Tanzania has had less ethnic division, partly because it had a sort of centralizing socialist state in the 60s that said, nope, we are all going to speak Swahili, and then basically mashed everyone together in a very deliberate process.
This is Kwame Anthony Appiah's analysis of Ghana, and he's got some good sense there because his dad was Kwame Nkrumah's right-hand man and all that, was that when Ghana was first unified, people were very enthusiastic about being Ghanaians, although the Ashanti are like one of the most historied kingdoms in Africa and very slaveholding-y, and so had lots of neighbors with lots of reasons to have grievance and so on. The mad top of this thing sort of blew up when Nkrumah then decided to become a Pan-Africanist or revealed that he was a super Pan-Africanist and decided to make that the foremost issue of his later presidency. And then he died, and that was a great relief. This is not Appiah's analysis. This is Addis Sparks' analysis. He sort of spoke to a bunch of Ghanaians who were like, yes, what a relief that Nkrumah died. And not just Ghanaians, by the way, a lot of other people in the AU who'd been saying we are also Pan-Africanists, which is relevant because Ramaphosa has been describing himself as Pan-Africanist. But the point is, after that, Ghanaians found it very easy to think of themselves as Ghanaians just because it was like a new thing and it kind of made sense. Like, we're all paying tax into the same pot. And like,
there was movement behind it at the time.
Yeah.
There was a lot of movement behind it at the time. And it's only when sort of Ghana working. Failed. And it
wasn't working very well. Exactly. Yeah.
That people were like, you know what, the reason that Ghana is failing is because the Ashanti over there are really, really being unpleasant and taking all the jobs, and actually those jobs belong to us.
And so this is why I mean, this is why the Institute of Race Relations works the way it does, I think, which is that it's pretty clear through history what makes race relations improve. In fact, what makes them become less salient, what makes these things dissolve into sort of stories that people might tell and disagree about now and then, but like that really don't get in the way of their lives, is when you're succeeding at other stuff. And in particular, succeeding through background conditions of the rule of law and a relatively limited
strong liberal institutions, healthy economy, et cetera, et cetera.
Then it's fine.
Right. Then, because then
all of this stuff becomes nerdy. Then when Nicholas is like, I don't know if the Cossacks came from here or from there, and Gabriel's like, I don't know if they came from here or from there, people who lean in and listen to that are not looking for a reason to stab someone in the eyeball. they're passing the time, and they're wondering about how things used to be. That's when it's working. To get it working, you need to get this, you know, to get the race relations better. Turns out it's very easy to take, if things start going badly and you'd like to become famous, just come out as a hardcore racist, because lots of people will get behind you. And then it's hard to do the other thing. But if you can turn around the ship, then
because clumping down into a tribe, whatever that tribe is, well, the race is a very easy one because it makes sense in the like sort of kinship way our brains are built. It's how we're hardwired. When things are going bad, it's like retreat to the tribe, put out the spears, and wait for the harsh weathers to blow over, because you think that your tribe being sort of related to you will probably be nicer to you than people who aren't. And that makes sense when you're a hunter-gatherer on the steppes of Eurasia or on the savannas of Africa. But when you're living in a giant city of millions of people, it's really not that useful.
Yeah. You can also see this anytime people go to prison. And I mean, I quite like the idea. I went to prison a few times, on community service.
Yeah, I was about to say, the story's about to get good.
like I've been arrested, but we're not going to talk about that.
That was the Leeuwkop prison project or something, wasn't it?
Yes.
Because I remember our school used to have,
We used to go read and like talk about homework and life. And, you know, like the theory was you go there and help juvenile detainees.
Study.
And some of them are not juvenile, they're adults, but they've decided to finish their high school.
Right.
So they're like in their early 20s. And Lord knows whether it is good for anything. I don't. But it seemed, I don't know. I hated the experience when we left and I saw chaps pat each other on the back because I hoped that it was good, but it was very easy to think that it was kind of fun, but not actually helpful. I don't know, but anyway, we definitely didn't go nearly often enough, I think, to deserve any
to make a real difference, yeah,
credit, yeah. But we did go often enough to kind of get some insight into how dudes describe prison life. You know, on the third or fourth time you're chatting with a dude for several hours, I felt like I was getting past the you know, him trying to tell me what I wanted to hear,
right.
And it is amazing, the diversity. And for example, belonging to the group that volunteers to go back to school, like I don't, but that is a gang. That becomes a gang. No,
right. It's the people. It's the people who have some sort of hope for the future, right? As opposed to the ones who are like, "What's the point?"
Yeah. But it's not like 50-50. You know, there's lots and lots of different gangs and groups and ways that people coalesce. And then, you know, some of the guys are like, you know, and for a while, this seemed like a sideshow. And then, you know, after that guy, you know, after a couple of fights and this is and that, It's like, no, this is, this turns out to be my main gang. Like,
school gang, I mean, represent.
I'm a school gang.
So that's I think what we should end on here, which is that if you're gonna belong to a gang in prison, belong to the school gang.
Dude, I totally, that's absolutely my recommendation for the week. Like, belong to this, not the school gang where you fight for or against one version of history, but where you like are very fight to try and figure out which is the right one. Okay, we can't end there. I'm going to end. If we had another topic that we were going to mention, I will just say it for anyone who's still listening. That if you haven't seen the story about Cyril Ramaphosa saying that he would cover up for, in part, the Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma campaign in 2017, and in part for just general abuse of the taxpayers' money. You should check out the story. The audio, the leaked audio, you know, I'm sure we will learn more about its veracity. So far, it's been taken very seriously.
Cyril keeps falling for leaked audio. I mean, this has happened ever since he told that Gorgor that the Boers were going to take away her house or whatever. Like,
she said, yeah, really, he said should... in 2014 they're going to bring back apartheid. Also, he said in like 1992 we're going to boil the whiteys like frogs. That was, I wish he would have.
Like, the dude really needs to be careful about recording devices, because he's clearly not very good at being delicate.
At being delicate. I mean, I think, look, from the transcriptions, I haven't listened to the audio. I've read sort of extended quotations. I think it is relatively delicately phrased, but it's pretty sweet if you think from inside an ANC perspective, if you think the following, which is so easy to do, especially for a childhood lover of the ANC like me. I really want this party to survive. This party is the Liberation Party. It is the only party occupied by people who truly fought for the liberation of South Africa, who truly put everything on the line. Of course, there were allies and there were assistants, but this was the vanguard of freedom. And those people who fought for it, some of them have passed away, Ahmed Kathrada, Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, O.R. Tambo, but Joe Slovo, let's not get too complicated, but many of them are still alive. Many of us are still alive. And it is our duty to hold on to power, because we, and only we, really know how to keep this country in hand and keep it going forward. And he has this awkward problem where corruption has become very endemic. And so government finances, firstly, the State Security Agency was completely corrupted by Arthur Fraser and Jacob Zuma. It was being run literally at a COO, chief operations level, by someone who was supposed to be in jail, but was still collecting a salary outside of jail as the chief operating officer of the security agency. It's amazing. It's
good work if you can get it.
There was a slush fund of hundreds of millions of rands at least being used to buy cars and prostitutes and all the good things in life, maybe billions of rands, and a lot of that money in that slush fund. And, you know, by the way, every security agency in the world has a slush fund, and that really is true. So it was a smart place to go. Rather than the money going to the prostitutes and the cars for Arthur Fraser's cronies, someone decided to use some of that money on busing in supporters to this campaign rally event, or buying T-shirts for that, or buying dinner for the other, in order to have a contest about who should take over the ANC after the nightmare of Jacob Zuma. Surely that is a better way to spend the money. And surely you and I can understand that is a much better way to spend the money. But if it gets out to the public, those irritating little nitpickers at the Democratic Alliance and in all of the media houses are going to get so excited that government taxpayer money has been used once again, not the way it was supposed to be used, and this time it is used in the contest between CR17 and NDZ. It is going to distract us from our revolutionary task of uplifting poor black people by giving jobs to rich black people. It's complete distraction, and we cannot allow it. We must stop this immediately. And so I nobly will allow all the heat to fall on me. He says, Ramaphosa says, I will fall on my sword, which is hilarious. That's not what he means. He says, you know, let them just focus on the CR17 side. They mustn't look at the NDZ side. I won't politicize this. And let them rather think that it came from dodgy business people than that it came from the party.
Ah, what a hero. What a wonderful hero we have. I must say, as a kind of, you know, perhaps saying more about that my own twisted soul, the continuous and slow tarnishing of Saint Cyril's reputation does delight me.
Oh, dude, I get both Schadenfreude and actual empathy tragedy out of it, because I was once a believer. But I think it affirms the talking point that I have tried to put out there a lot, and that I was actually writing up, and then I sort of abandoned it this week just before the footage came out, which made me feel stupid. I should have published thing last week and then been vindicated.
Then you would have looked like a genius.
Well, I am a genius because I said it on the Daily Friend show. So it's on public record.
Which I don't know. I doubt there's, like, I think the number of people who listen to the Two Crickets and don't listen to the Daily Friend show is very small. But if you are one of those people, listen to the Daily Friend show.
Yeah, it's very good. I agree. And you will hear me saying, Cyril Ramaphosa is the head of the RET faction. This is not controversial.
Beautiful.
Radical economic transformation is a policy position that was established and elaborated under Thabo Mbeki, that was then fought about under Jacob Zuma, and then was then brought to fruition under Cyril Ramaphosa. Its key pillars were expropriation without compensation, nationalizing the healthcare service, prescribing assets to deal with whatever fallout there might be, nationalizing the Reserve Bank. And Cyril Ramaphosa has not managed to achieve any of these, but he has said categorically that nationalizing the Reserve Bank is something that he wants to do. He's just not ready for it yet. He came onto the ticket with EWC being his signature policy, something that he was pushing. The national health insurance move is happening. He has said repeatedly that the excellent performance of government healthcare under the coronavirus and and he manages to say this without smiling, which is why I think we should respect him, because that is impressive.
I couldn't do that.
I mean, he does laugh right, like a real ass of the time.
I will say though that, like, maybe this is just because I like things that are kind of like round, but I think that he has like a really lovable face.
Truly, truly, truly.
Like, it's just. He just doesn't look, you know, Zuma could vacillate between looking sort of fun and looking really creepy. But Cyril always just looks a bit kind of fun.
Yeah, he looks cuddly. He looks pretty cuddly. Anyway, he's the editor. If RET has anything to do with policy, let me tell you the most exciting thing about it. In 2017, South Africa's largest ever, I'm talking about the opposition, not our survey, the largest ever survey in South Africa to do with politics. Unfortunately, we got pipped. We do the best because we do it regularly, but one off, commissioned by ENCA, asked the question of the ANC base, would you like radical economic transformation? Would you like more of the same, or would you like more business-friendly solutions? Coming out of the NASRIC 2017 conference. Coming in at stone cold last with about 18.5% approval was radical economic transformation. Coming in at first place was more business friendly solutions. Coming in at second place was more of the same. If you line up those results with the preference for Cyril Ramaphosa versus the preference for Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, it was exactly the same. A 5-1 preference for Ramaphosa over Dlamini Zuma. and every reason in the world to believe that the reason people preferred Ramaphosa over Dlamini Zuma was that he looked like he would oppose radical economic transformation. In that sense, he is the most successful leader of radical economic transformation the ANC has ever had. Nelson Mandela actually opposed radical economic transformation. Thabo Mbeki pontificated so much that he ended up opposing radical economic transformation. Jacob Zuma fumbled his way into some radical economic transformation, and then it got very unpopular, and then Ramaphosa came in seeming to be an opponent of it, even while and whereafter. I mean, at the time, I was fooled. I thought I liked him because I thought he would oppose radical economic transformation. But for the last 4 years, he's done nothing but push it. And he's pulled off the trick of getting a whole faction to be named the Radical Economic Transformation faction that he's not in charge of. Even though he is literally signing and swearing to all of the Radical Economic Transformation positions. And even though he's now on tape, if the tape is accurate, saying, you know, look, the last thing we need is for people to start asking hard questions about the party, because what we really have to do is some radical economic transformation.
All right. And on that note, let us call it. Recommendations. I have one, a YouTube channel called Anton Petrov, and this dude just talks about science discoveries. He reads scientific papers and then he just talks about what they found. And he's got videos basically every single day, literally. And he mostly talks about stuff going on in space. You know, oh, scientists discovered like a weird new star. Scientists discovered this weird, wave coming out of space. They discovered a strange bacteria in this part of the ocean. And I think that it's the kind of content where if you watch too much of it at once, you're probably going to be a bit fatigued because it can be a bit much. But if you're interested in that stuff, it's really, really good. So that's Anton Petrov. I will put it in the description, which I forgot to do last time. Gabriel, your recommendation?
I recommend the Super Bowl of Economics, as it's been dubbed by super nerds.
Yeah, no, there's no such thing, I'm afraid.
So I was fortunate to get onto this pretty early last year. Facebook just flashed it at me because I'm friends with Princeton University on Facebook. The first debate was held last year around this time between Nobel Prize winning New York Times columnist, Princeton professor Paul Krugman, the great behavioral economist who really has some excellent insights and sometimes lets his linguistic acumen get ahead of his critical thinking, particularly when
that's putting it mildly.
His linguistic acumen is in service to his sort of working class sentiment. He sometimes gets sort of quite pro the already rich and anti poor in the name of being super left. But I think, you know, I suppose that's a fair, I suppose you could say that about a lot of people. Anyway, I really have got some serious complaints about Krugman. I won't get into that. I think that he's an amazingly intelligent guy. I think that he's the smartest guy on the left. And on the other side is Larry Summers, was president of Harvard, was basically removed because let's not get into that. He has recuperated his reputation and enjoys the respect of many as a proper center left dude. And my joke about American politics for the last 7-8 years has been there is no center left. The thought there being in part that for centrists to thrive, especially radical centrists, it's better off if you've got center left and center right guys thriving as well. Their debate last year was about inflation. And Paul Krugman, the Nobel laureate, said that it's transitory, that the trillions of dollars that had been invented by the American government were not really going to cause much of an inflation, that the money was helicoptered properly, that the marginal propensity to spend that money, meaning the rate at which people were saving it versus spending it, would result in a kind of slow drip, like in a hospital, into the body of the economy at such a rate that prices would, you know, maybe there'd be a little surge, but that it wouldn't last much more than a quarter or two, and that the thought that inventing all of these thousands of dollars that were being given to everyone would ultimately tax people further down the line, even if it's not being paid for by taxes because it's going to create an inflation, was a sort of old-fashioned monetarist, Milton Friedman kind of position. And Larry Summers made the argument that what's going to happen is what actually ended up happening. So that was last year. It was a fascinating discussion. I thought it was the most intelligent discussion about the inflation prospects that there were. They then had round two, because that started out as just a little Princeton economics sort of working seminar thing that was just being put on their Facebook, and like 50 people watched it. But then it kind of went viral. So they had another one this year again. And Paul Krugman was pretty cringy and apologetic, and Larry Summers was very magnanimous, as he often is, in trying to emphasize the point of agreement. But he's also quite harsh. He can't help himself. And so you see two very diverging views about what's coming ahead, which I think is very interesting. And I say that my sort of final note will be that I will follow Krugman in one regard, which is that I find myself scratching my head very hard. And I think this lecture I've just described, or this debate that I've just described, is a good place to start thinking about it. But a lot of people shared a similar position to me, which is that Bitcoin, if it's good for anything, you know, it's clearly not particularly useful for transactions. At a commercial level, it might be good for backing up transactions, but at the moment, clearinghouses behind credit card companies are currently still better at Bitcoin than that. So if it's good for anything, it's good as a hedge against the dollar, which means it's a hedge against inflation, which means if inflation goes up, Bitcoin. If the dollar gets weaker, Bitcoin should get stronger. The opposite has happened. As inflation outlooks on the US dollar have cemented into a pretty high inflation zone for the coming period, Bitcoin's value has not quite halved, but just about dropped by quite a serious amount, from a peak to above where it was, I don't know, a year plus ago. But it's that hedge story is, I'm not saying it's dispelled, but it's under an interesting kind of stress. I think we've done pretty well not to talk about Bitcoin too much on this podcast, because it's a kind of rabbit hole that somehow when people start talking about it, they never stop talking about it. But
also one of us is perhaps more, let me put this way, one of us is less laconic than the other. And that problem would only be vastly inflated if you talked about Bitcoin, because I have no intelligent opinions on Bitcoin whatsoever. I barely understand how it works. So if we did talk about the economics of it.
Neither do any of the guys who are buying it.
I know that there's actually not a lot of people who understand Bitcoin, but I'm very firmly in that camp. And so the conversation would be very like, yeah, so I think this. I don't know, Nick, do you agree with me? I guess, yeah.
I hear you. Look, and I don't want to give anyone the misapprehension that this is a debate about Bitcoin. This is a debate about US dollar inflation. Recapping on what was said last year between these two brilliant guys who by the way, the Princeton guys picked up on it because Krugman and Summers ended up having a go at each other in the New York Times in writing. And so they thought, well, maybe it'll be more interesting if you
so much
more
civilized than Twitter.
And it really was. I mean, if you want to go back and watch the one from last year, it's probably a good idea. A little bit. I mean, I don't want to. Sounds too cruel to say it because Krugman really was pretty, not just wrong in what he predicted. I think quite wrong in how he thought about it. In some ways, quite right about how he thought about it. Anyway, I think that it's nice sometimes to touch on that kind of stuff. And what I find very pleasant is that if you're watching something on YouTube and there's a term that they throw in, I looked up SI curve. Larry Summers finished the thing by saying he's one of his problems is that he's a bit SI curve hesitant or skeptical. I was like, I don't know what that means, actually. Then I Googled it and then I was like, oh, that's what it means. Pretty simple. You know, so you can pause and Google. If you feel like that kind of listening experience, I recommend that debate.
Cool. So where can we find it again?
On YouTube. If you YouTube Summers Krugman Princeton, I'm sure it'll be the first thing up, but we will also put the link, presumably.
I'll go look at the link. Okay. And with that, wherever you are, whoever you are, whatever you're doing, keep the flow of liberty flying.
Oh, yeah.